So as we celebrated the festival of Bodhidharma, I thought I'd talk a bit about Bodhidharma, but mainly I'd like to talk a bit about the scripture that we recited. Mm. I'd just like to start off by saying at the beginning, nobody knows whether Bodhidharma really existed or not. you know, scholars are not sure that he did, but it doesn't actually matter. The teaching has come down to us somehow, and this scripture came from somewhere, and it doesn't really matter whether we know the names of the particular people who were involved or whether it doesn't. Mm-hmm. There were certainly some means by which meditation practice made its way from India to China, and some means by which that was spread in China. And either one person or a number of people who pointed to the importance of meditation, and whether this scripture really is a dialogue that actually occurred between Bodhidharma and his disciple, or whether it's later teachers trying to explain meditation in the through the vehicle of that dialogue. Again, it really doesn't matter. It's the teaching that's being pointed to that matters. If Bodhidharma did exist, it was somewhere around 600 and something, so it's a long time ago. Written records were, well, China was very advanced even then, but written records of this particular, what was going on there in terms of Buddhism and meditation, are not, I think, sufficient to be able to establish. It's only a few generations really later that they start seriously making lineage charts and kind of taking note of who the teachers were and what happened and how things spread. The standard biography, if you like, of Bodhidharma, that he was from southern India and that he trained under a teacher called Prajñātara on our ancestral line Hanyatara, who it's also said was a female monastic. And he trained there for a long time, and it's said that he was maybe something like 60 when he went to China, so he was already getting on in years. I can't remember the numbers now. It took him something like 20 years to get there, or, you know, he did go by sea. I think he kind of popped up the coast of India and then across to China somehow. But again, you know, that the historicity of it isn't really that important. Mm-hmm. And it said that when he got to China, he went to see the emperor of the part of China that he landed in, and had an interchange with the emperor of China, which I'm not going to talk about today. That's a story for another time. And as a result of that, he headed across the Yangtze River and ended up at Shaolin Monastery, where there was Buddhism was already in China. There were already Buddhist monasteries. Mm-hmm. He went to Shaolin Monastery, and there was known as the wall-gazing monk, because he just sat facing a wall, whereas all the others, their main practice wasn't meditation. It was, you know, reading the scriptures, perhaps ceremonial, making offerings, running the monastery, practicing the Vinaya. So they were practicing as monks, but they perhaps didn't have meditation at the core of their practice in the way that Bodhidharma absolutely did. And it is, as we recite in Rules for Meditation, it says he spent 9 years facing a wall, and that was his practice to clarify perhaps some of the things that didn't go so well in the interview with the Emperor of China. And because he didn't spend his time touring around trying to convert people, he had very few disciples, and there were just a small number who came to him at Shaolin and trained with him there. And it's only several generations later, really, that Chan Buddhism, as it came to be, becomes widespread in China. So it's really just a handful of people for several generations, a very small number. Anyway, enough on Bodhidharma. I wanted to have a reasonably good look at this scripture, because it's got such a lot in it. I'm mainly going to focus on the the first part of it. And personally, I find this to be a really kind of practical and pragmatic description of the meditation practice, which really kind of goes to the heart of what it's about and what are we actually doing or not doing when we sit in meditation. And it's, as I said, it's put in the form of a dialogue between Bodhidharma and his disciple Ekka. And this is obviously when Ekka is maybe first come to Bodhidharma or hasn't been there long. So he's being portrayed as almost a beginner, someone who's coming to practice. And the question he's given at the beginning, Bodhidharma's disciple Ekka asked, "If sincere people are committed to seeking the Buddha's way, what methods for training should they undertake?" It's the basic practice of almost anyone coming to any kind of practice, certainly coming to Buddhist practice. Okay, I'm sincere about this. I really want to do it. What do I do? And as the dialogue goes on, it becomes very clear very quickly that Ekka is basically wanting a technique. He's wanting a method that he can follow, and that by following that method and putting it into practice, he will get to wherever it is he thinks he wants to get to. Bodhidharma, in all his answers, is trying to undercut that and trying to point out that actually it's not about having a method, and even if we do have a method, that's not going to bring about the results that we might hope it would. So Ekka asks, if sincere people are committed to seeking the Buddha's way, what methods for training should they undertake? What methods? And Bodhidharma replies, "Since meditation embraces techniques and methods, I call it the essential practice." And Ekka's reply shows that he's just heard that still as meditation being another method or another technique, because he says, "How can one single method embrace all practices?" But Bodhidharma hasn't said there is a method which embraces techniques and practices. There's a technique that embraces all techniques. He says that meditation embraces, in the sense of being what underlies techniques and practices. It's not about having techniques and practices. Meditation is the essential thing. And here, meditation is a translation of Zazen, seated meditation. So when Ekka asks how can one single method embrace all practices, Bodhidharma makes it a bit clearer that he's not talking about a method. He replies, "It is the root and source of all methods." And then this next sentence I find absolutely really helpful, really goes to the heart of things. "All methods are simply products of the mind. So if you are able to thoroughly comprehend what real mind is, then your myriad practices will all be fully equipped." And it's this sense of all methods are simply products of the mind. If we're intent on putting into practice a method or a technique that our own mind has come up with, or someone else's mind, but basically human minds have come up with this way of doing things, then we find ourselves always being within this closed loop of things that my mind can come up with. It becomes an intellectual pursuit, or it becomes a trying to figure something out through the power of my mind. And so we're always limited to what my mind can imagine, what it can envisage, what it can encompass. Bodhidharma, instead of talking about methods, points us to being able to thoroughly comprehend what, in quotes, real mind is. And I'll come back to that in just a second. But he's saying that meditation and the comprehension of real mind is the root and the source of all these methods. And if we come to know this real mind that's the root and source of all these methods, then our myriad practices, all the things that we do, will be fully equipped. This is actually very similar to Dogen saying in Rules of Meditation that the means of training are thousandfold and pure meditation must be done. If we understand the heart of pure meditation, then all the ways in which in our daily life we go about things in a way that's in harmony with meditation, make those things our practice, they will all be fully equipped if we understand the heart of where they're coming from. Now, if we go back to this phrase, real mind, this is the heart of what Bodhidharma's talking about. He says, if you're able to thoroughly comprehend what real mind is. And it's a bit confusing for us, perhaps, because he's talking about real mind, thoroughly comprehending that, rather than methods and techniques being simply a product of the mind. The word mind is being used in two different ways there. So what's actually the distinction he's drawing there? And I think when we talk about all methods are simply products of the mind, that's the intellectual discursive thinking mind that we're very familiar with, the mind that makes decisions, assesses things, puts things into practice in that way. Talking about real mind, I don't read the Chinese or the Japanese, but the character there for mind is the character in Japanese is called Shin. And it's sometimes translated as mind, sometimes as heart, and sometimes as heart stroke mind. The reason for not always using mind is partly to distinguish it from this thinking mind, which is the first bit that we were talking about. But heart isn't quite it either, in the sense that it's not an organ or a physical kind of location. And heart stroke mind, I'm not even sure what that is. It's trying to point at something. What it's trying to point to is, I think another way of describing it is, what is it that is at the heart of a human being, at the heart of existence? And another phrase that we have for trying to point to that is the phrase true nature. What is the true nature of a human being? The true nature of a human being is the nature of Buddha, the nature of all existence. So what Bodhidharma is pointing to is, rather than being involved in techniques of the thinking mind, if you're able to thoroughly comprehend what the true nature of a human being is, what our birthright is, what this Buddha nature is that we are expressions of, if we can come to understand that, then all the ways that we try and put things into practice in the techniques, methods, whatever else that we do, those things will be fully equipped, in the sense that we will understand the root and the source of them. We will understand the context within which we're doing them, because we're not then doing the things that we do in order to bring about an outcome. And that's what the methods and techniques are about. They're trying to bring something about. But if we come to thoroughly comprehend what true nature is, then there's no outcome that we're looking for. And then, just as Dogen says, the practices are then not practices to try and become Buddha. They're practices that express Buddha, that express our understanding of true nature. And the link then he makes between the coming to understand that and all of the practices that we then do in our lives, he uses this metaphor of the tree. Your real mind is as a great tree. You could perhaps say your entire being or your entire life is as a great tree. Its branches, blossoms and fruit all depend completely on the root. And the root is that this true nature, understanding of true nature. If we understand that, then the trunk, the branches, the fruit all grow naturally. Even a severed tree will survive if its root is intact, and it will regrow again. Whereas a fully grown tree, once cut off from that root, will die. If those practices are not connected to, or are not practiced within an understanding of true nature, they just become empty rituals, or they just become intellectual exercises. Mm. But if connected with the root, even if all of those drop away, as they might if we lose our mental faculties or perhaps lose our physical ability to do things, all those practices that we once did, all those ways of living that we once engaged in, we might not be able to do. But nevertheless, if the root, if our understanding of true nature is there, then there is something we're still rooted in, however much or however little we're able to function. And he says that if you train in the way with a thorough comprehension of what real mind is, then you'll conserve your strength as you easily succeed in realizing Buddhahood. On the other hand, if you try to train without thoroughly comprehending what real mind is, then you will squander your efforts to no avail. I think it's really pointing to the heart of the meditation practice, in the sense that if the practices that we engage in aren't based on that, then we're just looking in the wrong direction. So however much effort we put into the efforts and practices, if they're done on the understanding that there's something we're missing that they will bring about, then we're just looking in the wrong way, we're looking in the wrong place. If instead we come to, just by sitting and being willing to see what is here and come to know the Buddha that's here already, if we come to a thorough comprehending, thorough understanding, as Bodhidharma describes it, of that Buddha within, then we will easily succeed, in the sense that the practices then aren't about success and failure. There's no outcome that they're actually trying to bring about. So they inherently, the more we understand the root that Bodhidharma's pointing to, the more we understand that true nature of the Buddha within, the practices inherently express that. And so we easily succeed in realizing Buddhahood, realizing it in the sense of actualizing it, making it real in our lives. And that making it real in our lives is because we understand the root that it's expressing, the Buddha nature that it is manifesting. And the next two lines, Bodhidharma says, be aware therefore that all good and evil proceed from your own mind. And then I really like this next line. So that when your own mind seeks for something outside and separate from yourself, you are missing the point. And it's the sentences that like that the Bodhidharma has that I find really, I really resonate for me. Yeah. There's something just so straightforward about that. That if you looking for something that's outside and separate from yourself, you're just missing the point. You're just looking in the wrong place. If we think that there's something lacking that we need to get from the outside, and we're always looking for that, looking how to fill that hole that we perceive, and we spend all our efforts trying to fill in this perceived hole, we don't get anywhere in the end, because we haven't realised that the issue here is not that there's a hole and it needs filling, it's that we have a perception of a hole. And why do we have that perception of a hole? Who actually says it's like that? Why have we come to that assumption? Instead of looking for Buddha outside, if we sit in meditation and are willing to come to know this existence that's here and now, the more we come to know that and clarify that, we come to see that this is Buddha already. The Buddha isn't outside somewhere. Well, yes, it is. It's outside everywhere, but it's not missing within. And it's crucially this Buddha that's us, that we're expressing, that we need to come to know about. And we come to know about that not through trying to put into practice a technique that's going to somehow establish it or find out about it or figure it out, but by letting go of techniques and just being willing to sit and come to know the real mind that Bodhidharma points to, the true nature that is this being already. There's an awful lot of this in this scripture, and I'm not going to try and go through the whole lot. I think I'm just going to stop at that point. I'd just like to finish off reading the last bit. If you can illumine what is within, the constant light of your awareness and scrutiny will eradicate the three poisons of greed, hate and delusion, so that your numberless spiritual qualities will all be naturally perfected through and through. Go beyond the mundane and attest to that which is saintly. It is before your very eyes, not off in the distance. Awakening is but an instant away. Why stay troubled until your hair has turned grey? Would that I had explained for you the subtle mysteries of the gate to the Dharma in depth, rather than discuss the mind in barest outline, detailing but such a scant portion of the reason for which we train. Again, I really like that, because he's encouraging us here and now to engage with the practice. It's something that's right in front of us. It's right within us. And at the same time, he's not saying, "Oh, it's simple, it's easy." He's saying, you know, this is a very abridged version of something that actually the scripture goes on for tens of pages. And at the end of it, of this long dialogue, he says, I wish I'd be able to explain to you the subtle mysteries of the gate to the Dharma. All I've been able to do is actually just scratch the surface, just give you discuss the mind in barest outline, detailing but such a scant portion of the reason for which we train. So at the same time, he's pointing out that it's right in front of us, it's right within our grasp. Right within us here and now, and at the same time, there's an immense depth to it. We, as we carry on with the practice, we keep unfolding more and more.